be seated. This is 69048 Pacific Western Bank, First District Court. Counsel is ready to proceed.
Yes, Your Honor.
Petitioners, Pacific Western Bank.
Yes, Your Honor. Court. Bob Wilson and Snow Miller on behalf of Petitioner of Pacific Western Bank. Good. Also present from my office are Kelly Dove and Carl Riley. They've assisted with this petition.
And Mr. Olson, just to advise you and opposing counsel, one reason we scheduled this for argument, because you know the history of this case and all the various proceedings have been before the court already, is we don't have a clear rule on this based on this factual situation here with the Wells Fargo advisors located in Nevada, but this other company's in New Mexico, and we thought it was a good case maybe we could tackle and try and clarify the law. And so we're interested in what both sides think about your statement, Section 68. I know it's an issue, and we'd like both of you to comment on that. Should we follow that or not follow it, and why? And that'll help us maybe focus the argument where what we want to drill down into. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that, Your Honor. We believe that this case should end with the restatement, second of conflict, section 68. As we detailed before the lower court and in our repetition, virtually every case that we've located that addresses this issue has followed the approach of the restatement. And the restatement approach is basically this. If a court has jurisdiction over a bank or a broker, and in this case, the state of Nevada and the court here has jurisdiction over Wells Fargo Advisors because it does business here, you can execute on a debt that broker owes to its customer, in this case Mr. Badger, regardless of where that debt is located. In other words, it's an intangible personal property, and if you have jurisdiction over the institution, in this case Wells Fargo Advisors, you can force them to honor the writ of garnishment.
So your point is that money is different than like an automobile or so chattel, a piece of personal property than like that as far as jurisdiction.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think the restatement draws upon that distinction because Section 67 talks about personal property. And basically, if it's personal property that is tangible, like a car, I've used examples of pigs and horses in the past, you've got to go where the car, or the pig, or the horse is located. With the debt, you just need jurisdiction over the garnishing. We've examined a number of cases, and this is a fairly obscure issue of law, but we've examined a number of cases that seem to deal with this issue. And in no particular order, I'll start with the Country Bank case. Country Bank is interesting because it involved the 529 plan. In that case, the plan was a New Hampshire plan managed by Fidelity, a Connecticut judgment, and a New York garnishment. And the court held that the New York garnishment or attachment, I think they use a restraining notice, is the technical term, was valid to tie up that account. And the court went further and said, since that account is located in New Hampshire and the New York exemption only exempts 529 plans under New York law, it's not exempt. A second example is the Ellsworth case out of Arizona, which followed the restatement. Very simply, in that case, you had a Canadian life insurance company doing business in Arizona. You had an Arizona judgment debtor. You had a judgment debtor that was subject to jurisdiction in Arizona. The judgment creditor served a writ of garnishment on the Canadian insurance company in Arizona to garnish annuities that were being payable to the judgment debtor from a Canadian life insurance company. The judgment debtor argued, obviously, this court doesn't have jurisdiction because this is a Canadian entity, you have to go to Canada to get the funds. The court held, well, under the restatement, if you've got jurisdiction over the garnishee, you've got jurisdiction to compel them to honor the writ of garnishment. Same kind of result was reached in the Bank of Montreal case we've cited in our reply, which is, I believe, 113 years old. And in that case, you had a Canadian bank that had a branch in Chicago. Attachment was served upon the Chicago branch, and they held that was sufficient to garnish or execute or attach funds located in the Canadian branch, or a Canadian branch of that bank. So it seems to me that the rule is unanimous, Your Honor. If you've got jurisdiction over the garnishee, you've got jurisdiction to make that garnishee pay the debt.
Well, Let me ask you this, and the second issue is, should we interpret the exemption provisions on a 529 account under NRS 21.090, what's exempt, what isn't, or is that not properly squared up at this stage of the case?
I think it is properly squared up at this stage in the case. It was briefed below. It was argued below. It was apparently rejected by Judge Gonzalez when she told us to go to New Mexico. And I think, Your Honor, with respect to the Nevada exemption, there's a few things we need to consider. First is the timing. On July 22nd, 2015, the writ was served on Wells Fargo Advisors. 15 days later, on August 14th, we received claims of objection to the exemption. Those claims of exemption were limited to exemptions available under Nevada law. At no point was New Mexico law mentioned in those claims of exemption. Rather, those claims of exemption were brought up 37 days after the writ was served in the response to our opposition to the claim of exemption. 37 days. NRS 21.112 subsection 1 gives them 10 days to file that claim of exemption.
You're saying some time later, whether it's meritorious or not, it was an untimely request for the exemption?
Yes, Your Honor, but I think it's also without merit. The reason I say that is I would ask Your Honor to, you know, look at what's going on in this case. We have a California judgment that's been domesticated in Nevada, so we have a Nevada judgment. We have a Nevada judgment debtor. We have Nevada execution procedures in place, and they should be governed by Nevada law. If you look at NRS 21.090 subsection 1, that is the statute that lists our exemptions. And the statute begins by saying the following property is exempt from execution, except as otherwise specifically provided in this section or required by federal law. The exemption we're dealing with is buried on the second or third page of the statute. I'm not sure exactly how it's paginated, but it's way down in the statute, and it's NRS 21.010 subsection 1R5. And basically, you have a $500,000 exemption under that subsection of the statute that can be applied to four different types of federally qualified retirement devices, like IRAs or pension and profit sharing plans. And the fifth is 529 accounts. And if you look at that, the language states, a trust forming part of a qualified program pursuant to Chapter 353B of NRS, any applicable regulation adopted pursuant to Chapter 353B of NRS, and Section 529 of the Internal Revenue Code. The plain language of the statute, I think, limits the application of the exemption to 529 accounts formed under Nevada law. In Country Bank, we saw that same result with New York. If you look at the text of the New Mexico exemption that's cited in the record, I don't remember which page, it's limited to plans qualified under the New Mexico Educational Trust. It seems like the states that we've looked at, they limit the exemptions to 529 plans that are authorized by that state. I'm not sure why that is the rule across the country. Maybe they're trying to promote investments in that state's higher education system. But in any event, the statute doesn't say just any plan qualified under 529. It's limited to 353B. And that limitation, I think, compels this court to find that the exemption is not available to Mr. Badger in this case, who bears the burden of proving that he's entitled to the exemption.
How do you deal with the argument that's being made that, A, we don't have a bank involved, and the property is not really the property of the party, it's the property of the other establishment in New Mexico?
Your Honor, I'll treat that as two questions. First, is this limitation to a bank material? I think it is not. If you look at the cases we've cited, such as the Smith-Warning case, that dealt with a brokerage firm, it didn't draw that distinction. You look at the restatement, it's not limited to a bank. You look at the Ellsworth case, it was a life insurance company. You look at the Country Bank case, it was a 529 plan. The restatement and this rule has never been limited to just banks. Rather, it's do you have jurisdiction over the garnishee? And if you do, you can make them bring that debt back. I think the second point Your Honor raised, I'm trying to think of it. Could you ask the question again?
Basically, it's the property is not in the hands of a bank that was in fact garnished. It's in secondary hands.
That is a very good question, Your Honor. That question, the best case that we found addressing it would be the Hicks decision we cited in the reply. And the Hicks court took a little different approach, but I think it was reached the results that we're asking Your Honor to reach today. In Hicks, as I understand the factual background, a receiver obtained a prejudgment writ of attachment against a brokerage account that had various accounts within the brokerage account. And the broker honored that garnish and goes to funds. It was later determined that the writ of garnishment was, or the writ of attachment was improperly issued because a bond had not been posted. And we don't have a bonding issue in this case because we've got our judgment. And apparently, I think the broker was sued under the theory that they wrongly froze the funds. And the broker made two arguments to the court. The first is when we're served with the writ, we don't have to audit the writ. We don't have to go in and verify that it's accurate. We can rely on it. The court said yes. The second and more important issue is the court looked at the nature of the attachment and whether it was proper. And in doing so, the court looked at the Uniform Commercial Code that was adopted in Illinois, which is the same as Nevada. And the court analyzed UCC Section 8-112 and Comment C. Mm-hmm. And what the court said, and I'll just simply read from the decision, UCC Section 8-112C 1977 provides that the interest of a debtor in a security entitlement may be reached by a creditor only by legal process upon the securities intermediary with whom the debtor's security account is maintained. As the comment to this section explains, subsection C provides that a security entitlement can be reached only by legal process upon the debtor's security intermediary. Process is effective only if directed to the debtor's own security intermediary. If debtor holds securities through broker, and broker in turn holds through clearing corporation, debtor's property interest in or is a security entitlement against broker. Accordingly, debtor's creditor cannot reach debtor's interest by legal process directed to the clearing corporation. I think what this says is we could only garnish Wells Fargo Advisors. If we went to New Mexico, they could say, well, these funds or this account has been deposited into a brokerage account, and under the UCC you have to go there. And finally, Your Honor, I would note that this court has jurisdiction, and we requested the lower court to do this, this court has jurisdiction to set aside the whole Wells Fargo Advisors issue and say, Mr. Badger, the funds aren't exempt, turn them over. That is authorized under NRS 21.320. Are there any other questions at this time?
Not this time. I probably will after hearing from your opposing counsel, but no.
Thank you.
Well, Your Honor, may it please the court. It's my privilege to be here on behalf of Darren Badger, real party in interest. And the issue is whether or not this court has jurisdiction and whether or not the trial court had jurisdiction. And the only evidence that's in the record is what Wells Fargo Advisors itself when it responded to the writ. And it's stated in this writ response that these funds are not maintained by us. They're a wholly separate company that's located in New Mexico. It's not us, it's somebody else. And that is the remedy. That is the
invested through Wells Fargo Advisors in Nevada.
There is a brokerage account in St. George, Utah that Mr. Badger works with. Mr. Badger, whenever he wants to withdraw appropriate funds for educational expenses which are permitted under 529, communicates directly with Scholar's Edge. Those requests are made to Scholar's Edge. Scholar's Edge responds. Scholar's Edge sends the appropriate withdrawal, I guess, disbursement in that scenario.
What's the connection of Wells Fargo Advisors to this transaction?
My understanding, Your Honor, is other than just being a place that says, here are some of the accounts that you hold, that's their involvement.
Because the record doesn't seem to be clear on that point. It seems that he, at least from my basic understanding, is that he procured that account through that brokerage situation, and they are the parties that have placed it. This other information you're giving to us is kind of like the first time.
Right. Well, he actually, Your Honor, and if you look at the attachments,
so if you were to point to the record,
exactly.
I appreciate that.
To the response in the appendix shows that it's Scopium Group, which is an entity in St. George, Utah. That's where these funds are deposited with, and the withdrawals are made directly from Scholar's Edge. But once again, back to the record, the only thing that is in the record is what Wells Fargo Advisors responded. And it says, this is not us. This is a wholly separate entity. And the district court correctly recognized that. The issue of the timeliness of the exemptions or otherwise, there's nothing in the exemption statutes that states you have to list every one of your exemptions. An exemption was timely filed. And the objection to that claim for exemption, the bank then said, well, we don't think these qualify under Nevada statute, focusing on only one of the issues that the claim for exemption was based on anyway, which was the 529 plan under that specific provision of NRS 21.090. Never ever addressed the fact, and it's never been addressed either in the briefing or otherwise, never reached by the district court, because of the fact that the district court determined New Mexico was the proper forum to go to. We also had the objection or the claim of exemption, I guess, under NRS 21.09S, which says payments made pursuant to a court-ordered support. That part hasn't even been addressed. So, I mean, they want to leapfrog past the various issues. In addition, the three Badger children, Tatum, Brooke, and Gage, filed their own claims for exemptions, which, once again, hasn't been addressed. They're just running with the fact that the district court said you need to go to New Mexico. The issue of the exemption that applies, for whatever reason, that's what the literal language, the textual language of the statute says. It's limited to 529 plans. There's nothing that limits New Mexico's statutes to New Mexico residents. In fact, the case that was cited by the bank, which was the NRA Aero decision, specifically noted in that decision that they were going to permit a resident of California to claim an exemption in Michigan because there was no limitation on Michigan.
Generally, aren't exemptions the type you have to claim as a resident of the state? Like when you do it in bankruptcy court, you have to say, I'm a resident of Nevada, therefore I claim these exemptions under Chapter 21.
Not always, Your Honor. Not always, Your Honor. And the NRA Aero decision, which is a 1999 decision, is a perfect example of that, which permitted a California resident to assert a Michigan homestead exemption. And courts across the country are split. Some courts specifically state exemptions are limited to residents. And some statutes explicitly state that. In Nevada nor New Mexico have decided that issue. But if you look at the New Mexico statutory scheme, the issue of the 529 being exempt under New Mexico law is in a wholly separate chapter than its exemption statute. Is not limited to exemptions, is not limited to residents of New Mexico, despite the fact that New Mexico has various exemptions that are limited.
Are the three real parties in interest residents of Nevada?
Mr. Badger is a resident of Nevada, and I believe Mr. Ritter is not part of this petition.
Okay, and
Mr. Schroeder is not part of this specific petition.
So Mr. Badger is a resident
Yes, Your Honor, Mr. Badger is a Nevada resident. And if you look at what the court found, I mean, at page 28 of the transcript, the court's transcript specifically said this is an exemption that you need to have determined in the first instance by the courts of New Mexico. The court never even had the opportunity to address the other litany of issues that were raised, and these have not even been addressed by the bank, which again, such as the issue of NRS 21.09-01-S, which specifically says in what circumstances you do that. And these are amounts. We provided the information on the record. It was provided to the district court. It's part of the appendix, part of both the divorce decree that Mr. Badger had, that says you have to pay these amounts into the plan, as well as the fact that the three children, two of which are of the age of majority but are currently attending school, and these funds are necessary for their education, as well as the minor child, who raised their own claims of exemptions, which have not been passed on otherwise, Your Honor. And in this circumstance, you've got a situation where the claims of exemption were timely raised, appropriately raised. If they felt that there was an issue that was somehow not appropriately raised in the claim of exemption, first of all, there's nothing in the exemption statutes which requires a party to set forth every one. Yes, is the burden on the party asserting the exemption? Yes, it is. And I would submit Mr. Badger has met the burden on those issues. But other than to claim the exemption and meet the burden when it's called out, which he did, And even if there was a finding or a determination or a holding that somehow the Nevada statutes, which are silent on the issue, state that if you don't set forth the specific subdivision of an exemption or otherwise, that somehow you haven't properly preserved that, NRCP 15, Your Honors, this is a pleading. An exemption claim is nothing other than a pleading. It would be permitted to be amended. You have an issue that was tried by the consent of the parties, was fully briefed, argued at the hearing, the transcript is part of the record. They have more than adequate opportunity to go through these. So to raise an issue that somehow this was not properly preserved, yes, it was, Your Honor. It was brought up by the fact that they raised the issue and said, no, you can't have this specific one because it's limited to Nevada statute. Once again, glossing over all the other bases that were raised for the exemption.
Counsel, I'm really troubled because I'm reading the order that was submitted on behalf that denied the position you're taking, but it keeps talking about further ordered in the entirety of funds held in John A. Ritter's both individual retirement account, held with WFA through the Schofield Group brokerage account. And likewise, it talks about Ritter's annuity account held with WFA through the Schofield Group. So the order that was drafted on your behalf, even though it denies this, it states that he had an account through WFA that held this. And so how am I confused as to this? Please explain that.
And those are totally separate accounts, Your Honor. The IRAs and the annuity are totally separate accounts.
I understand that, but you're saying the point that jumps out to me is that they're held through WFA.
If I may, Your Honor.
Which is the leverage, so to speak, that they're asserting. So, and then you're telling us that it was centrally controlled by a brokerage that he had full control over, and WFA is not involved.
And it
was
literally not true. If you look at the response to the writ of garnishment, which was...
Well, I'm looking at the order drafted by your side that gives credence to this, and you're asserting the fact that I have to take as true because it was drafted by your side.
Your Honor, and I appreciate that, but the situation you have is you have a distinction between accounts. Those are accounts that are held through Wells Fargo Advisors. Wells Fargo Advisors responded to the writ. No one knew the response to the writ on those particular issues did they say those are anything other than Wells Fargo Advisors accounts. They froze those funds. They acknowledged the writ applied to those funds. Yet when they responded in reference to the 529 accounts, in the same document, they specifically stated, these are not our funds.
But you also, the last paragraph, it's further here by order that the entirety of the funds held in the Darren D. Badger SEP individual retirement account held. So it just keeps saying that all these things held through WFA.
And once again, WFA acknowledged in its response to the writ, it holds those funds. And nobody
you're
disputed
saying they
held
those 529 funds.
Right.
Funds,
so. Nobody disputed they held those funds. The 529 fund was
for the benefit of the children who are physically located. And again, it's... I'm having some problems.
Is there any evidentiary hearing on this?
There was no evidentiary hearing on this.
So we're kind of doing discovery here in the Supreme Court.
To a large extent. Those issues were not addressed because of the fact that the court determined it did not have the jurisdiction. And I can appreciate Justice Douglas' concern about how the order is drafted, but I think the distinction here is clearly set forth by the 529 plan in this circumstance. Is a different creature.
Depending upon a particular fact, it takes us right or left, and that's really what my concern is.
Right.
So I'm trying to drill down to say, what are the facts? And I can appreciate the distinction that you're drawing at this time.
And the only facts in the record, Your Honor, is what Wells Fargo responded to the writ. And in its response to the writ, it stated, those accounts that you described, that you say are part of it, yes, those are part of it. The 529 accounts, the response, the only evidence in the record, the only fact in the record, Wells Fargo says, this is not us. But even beyond that, Your Honor, you would still have the opportunity to claim the exemption under New Mexico law. That's not limited to New Mexico residents.
Nevada doesn't prohibit that. Once again, the very case that is cited by the bank for the
proposition. At this point, we may not get there. It's almost like putting the cart before the horse.
I'm just saying the district court, since we review the district courts, they haven't made a conclusion that Mexico law applies, have they? Or have I read this wrong? They just said, I read the same letter Justice Douglas is referring to, and I think it just said that they're exempt, but we didn't say under what law.
And in fact, the transcript specifically states, I did not at this point say the 529 accounts are going to be exempt. What I said was, since they're managed by a New Mexico entity that's governed by New Mexico law, which is a different statutory system, that I think you've got to go to New Mexico.
Okay, so the only issue before us today, I think, and sorry for wasting my time, but we're trying to get this right, is whether should we adopt Section 68, should we do that or not? In my opinion, I'd love to hear your comment on that. And the lawyer did say that it was quashed on the service on those 529 accounts, but it doesn't say on what basis other than jurisdiction. The court apparently felt because they're in New Mexico we couldn't touch them. So if we conclude that Restatement 68, Section 68, Subsection 2 Restatement 2 applies, I apologize, and then we could, it's kind of like we've got a series of dominoes to deal with before we get to the final issue.
I think so, Your Honor, and I think without belaboring the point, I mean, I think my client's position on the application of Restatement 68 in this scenario, as well as based on the only facts in the record, are what they are, and if this court does make the determination, whatever it decides under Section 68, but if it says that you can proceed with this bank in Nevada over Wells Fargo Advisors through extension through the Scholars Register New Mexico entity, I think there's a litany of issues that should be decided at the district court level and potentially even in other
districts. If we say restatement 68 second applies, we don't necessarily know the facts yet about what Wells Fargo's involvement is. It's only a legal issue of whether or not, if it were like an analogy to these bank cases that Mr. Olson cited, can they proceed through serving them in Nevada? Is that sufficient?
Exactly. And I think that sums it up as succinctly as I could do. And I think I have a minute or two left, and unless the court has additional questions, I'm not going to be waiting this any longer.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Olson?
Mr. Olson, tell us about Wells Fargo. since I got a dispute. Are these 529 accounts with Wells Fargo? What's the evidence? What's their nexus to the 529 accounts?
Your Honor, the nexus to the 529 accounts is they were disclosed in response to the writ of garnishment as being three accounts that Wells Fargo advisors had for Mr. Badger. Now, there is qualifying language, and I'm looking at Badger's excerpts from the record on page 169, there's a statement that says these shares are actually maintained at Scholar NM Custom, a mutual funds company, through the 529 plan accounts. Since these assets are not held at Wells Fargo Advisors LLC, they are not restricted pursuant to the writ of garnishment. Your Honor, we haven't had an opportunity to test that, but I think it's crazy to say that the accounts aren't with Wells Fargo Advisors when Wells Fargo Advisors discloses them in response to the writ of garnishment.
I got it.
Okay.
Now, with this case here, it looks to me like it's getting back to this, should we adopt this restatement 68 second, and then we got to maybe remand it to go from there, because you can do a third-party examination, similar to a judgment day examination on Wells Fargo and delve into this, but we don't really have all those facts right now, do we?
Your Honor, I think that would be one approach. But I think the second approach that I haven't seen any opposition to, and Badger hasn't given any lip service to, is this. We requested the court, I'll go back to the timing, July 22nd writ, August 28th response in support of the claim of exemption that first raised the New Mexico issue. The hearing was on September 1st. So we were under the gun to respond to that. But we did, in response to that, request the court to order Mr. Badger, pursuant to NRS 21.320, to withdraw the funds and deliver them to the judgment creditor for application on the judgment. I think an easier approach for your honors to take would be to order Badger to withdraw the funds, since they're not exempt under Nevada law, and deliver them to Pacific Western Bank.
I don't know how we can do that until we find out what Wells Fargo's connection is to these accounts and what I've mentioned in here, but there's been no discovery as to exactly the connection between Wells Fargo and this company in New Mexico. Now we've got a company in Utah, so we've got three states involved here.
Well, Your Honor, I think the court has jurisdiction over Badger. That's undisputed. And NRS 31.320 says the judge or master may order any property of the judgment debtor, not exempt from execution, in the hands of such debtor or any other person, or due to the judgment debtor to be applied towards satisfaction.
I understand. The problem we have in the Supreme Court is we're not fact finders. We don't have evidentiary hearings. So as you see in our decisions, we never find anything because we can't. Because we either conclude or hold. That's it. That's how we work. And then on the writ here, it's discretionary if we hear it. I mean, we heard it because the thing was such a morass, and now it's worse than I think we even imagined it. We felt we might have to clarify some of these legal issues to instruct the district courts how to proceed. Well, I don't think we can go quite that far, but you tell me why you think we can at this stage based on this record.
Two steps. First inquiry, is the 529 account New Mexico exempt? Answer should be not under Nevada law or no. Okay. Since it's not exempt, then you can go to NRS 21.
But the district court dodged that issue, not dodged it, it didn't reach that issue, because they said that we just don't feel we have jurisdiction over New Mexico, which I understand, but they didn't make a finding that it is exempt or not exempt, so how do we jump over them when they haven't addressed that issue yet?
Your Honor, it was raised in the record below, it was raised in the papers, and I think this court has jurisdiction to issue a writ of mandate based on the record before it. I mean, I don't think that it's limited necessarily to...
So if they're silent on it, you're saying we can still go ahead and address it then?
Absolutely. It was raised in the papers and raised...
It's definitely raised because it's in the order. You know, it's just as Douglas read it. It's right in there, you know, like that. So I was concerned about what opposing counsel read on that transcript trying to tell us what the background was and what happened. Well, sorry for all our questions. I apologize. We cut off your arguments a little bit, but we're trying to do the right thing and hear from both sides and make a correct legal decision. So,
I appreciate that, Your Honor.
Okay.
Does that mean I'm done?
I'll refer to Justice Douglas. This is a decision.
Anything you want to tell us, please do so.
Certainly. One thing I'd like to clarify, and that's the Arrow decision. That was a bankruptcy case. Apparently the judgment or the debtor resided in Michigan, filed for bankruptcy in California. The filing was proper because of the venue rules in bankruptcy court. And the court did allow the debtor in that case to use the California homestead exemption as to the, if I said New Mexico, I meant Michigan. My apologies. Against the Michigan property. And in so doing, the court stated, the California exemption statute does not limit the homestead exemption to dwellings within California. Our exemption statute with 529 plans limits them to 529 plans formed in Nevada.
Well, one thing, that's an interesting issue because you learn something every day, and I always thought you had to be a Nevada resident to claim the Nevada exemption, so now we'll have to take a look at that issue because I just thought in the bankruptcy law, you got to pick, if you live here, you pick either the federal exemptions or the Nevada exemptions, and the Nevada ones are much more broad than the federal ones, so there was some advantage to debtors then, but I've never seen that issue come up before, but that's interesting.
It's a strange exemption issue you only see in bankruptcy cases, but in this case, the person lived in Michigan.
Right. So, okay, well, I'll tell you, we sure got a ton of good issues in this case. Let's see what we can get to with them like that.
Thank you.
With that, Counsel, both sides, very interesting issue. That's why I was scheduled for the argument. And if the flow looks good, I appreciate the arguments. And I'll send some